18 years ago, I published a paper along with some colleagues at the Stroud Center called Climate Change and the Life Histories and Biogeography of Aquatic Insects in Eastern North America. And in that paper, we made a couple of predictions. One was that we took data from some actual streams along the east coast of North America, streams that, so these are actual temperature data from 30 degrees north to 52 degrees north latitude, different streams, and looked at what would happen if you added 4 degrees of heat to them over a course of a year, how far out to the right you would move. I'm not doing well with this pointer, where is it? Okay, so how far out to the right you would move this point, and what that would translate in distance. So we predicted that basically a 4 degree warming would warm streams approximately to the point where they would move them 680 kilometers of geographic distance. And then we predicted that the impact of that on stream insects that had univoltine life histories, in other words, exactly 1 year life cycles throughout their range, would be to shift that range north, and that mainly because most of these species had some sort of a diapause associated with their life cycle, especially an egg diapause, and that the egg diapause would put them in a good position to migrate further north and follow the global warming, but in the southern part of their range, down in here, the egg diapause probably wouldn't lengthen quick enough, given the rate of change of temperature, to enable them to maintain an exactly a 1 year life cycle, and they would go extinct. There's a number of things that bothered me over the last 18 years about those predictions. One thing was that they assumed that individual aquatic insects had little or no ability to acclimate to temperature. And secondly, they're all on univoltine species. The whole paper was on univoltine species, and it ignored aquatic species with more than one generation per year and that don't have any diapause. In other words, polyvoltine species. And so I always wanted to get back and try to take a look at those two issues. And for the reason being that, what about polyvoltine species? As Peter Adler pointed out earlier in the session, generation times are very temperature dependent. We all know that in polyvoltine species, there are more generations in the summer than there are in the winter, for example. Adult size is extremely temperature dependent in polyvoltine species. Usually, warmer temperatures produce small and less fecund adults. This is especially true during the summer. So a reasonable hypothesis would be that stream warming could both increase the number of generations per year in a polyvoltine species and produce a summer generation with females with insufficient fecundity to maintain the population. In other words, produce a generation in the summer that might be a bottleneck and actually cause the extirpation of the taxa in a given stream just because you have one generation of females that aren't producing eggs. And of course, that would all be the case unless they can behaviorally or physiologically acclimate to or otherwise compensate for changes in temperature. And so it's this bottom part of the hypothesis that we're exploring right now. So we have an ongoing study started this year. So the data I'm gonna show you are hot off the press. Some of them haven't even been analyzed statistically. Some of them were emailed me to me yesterday. So talk about a last minute talk, this is it. But basically the project we're doing this work on has nothing to do with global climate change, but the data are relevant. And in this project, what we're exploring is how does slow, intermediate, and fast changes in daily temperature affect the physiology, behavior, and life history of polyvoltine stream insects? And so at the Stroud Center, we created a whole new insect rearing lab over the winter. And this is a snapshot of part of the room. And we created a bunch of fairly big systems for rearing aquatic insects, racks of trays and troughs that put us in a position now to rear, we can rear any aquatic insect that we want to rear right now. And each rack can be kept at a different temperature regime. So we have five racks, so five potentially different temperature regimes with a lot of replication in a given rack. And in this project, we're looking at five different temperature regimes, and here they are. One of them is a control regime, and so it's insects reared in this regime are kept at a constant of 23.9 degrees centigrade over every 24-hour period. So it's a constant kind of temperature regime. But the other four temperature regimes are diurnally fluctuating over a 24-hour period. So they go from 20 degrees centigrade up to 28 degrees centigrade every day in a very repeatable fashion. Some of them go there very quickly, like this dashed line goes from 20 to 28 at a rate of 4.4 degrees centigrade per hour, and then stays at 28 for a long time, and then comes down very quickly at that same rate, and then stays at 20 degrees till the next day, and then goes back up, so it just repeats like that. And then other ones go there much slower, and then even slower, and then even slower. And so, but the key is that this experimental design is that the area under every one of these curves is exactly the same, so that a given bug kept in any one of these temperature regimes gets exposed to exactly the same amount of degree days or degree hours every day, which is exactly 23.9 degree hours to the tenth. I mean, it's exact. And with the computers and with sophisticated flash heaters and coolers and all, we can actually create these thermal regimes to within a tenth of a degree centigrade over the course of every 24-hour period. So for example, this blue line is the actual temperature tracing for our one of our temperature, these are actual tracings of actual temperatures over one cycle. So physically we've nailed it. We've got the system that can do this. And we throw bugs in these different regimes and we look at what happens. So these are the bugs that we are working on. These are all polyvoltine mayfly species. Right now we're working mostly with mayflies, mainly because one of the key parameters that we want to measure is egg production and adult size. And in mayflies, egg production and adult size completely reflects the quality of the larval period, because mayflies do not feed as adults. And so that's why we're focusing on mayflies. So these are some of the things that we're looking at. Metabolic rate, we're looking at metabolic acclimation. We look at egg development, the rate of hatching, the success of hatching for eggs. The full life cycle studies where we're rearing larvae from first instar all the way through to the adult stage. How long does it take? How big, when do they emerge relative to one another? How big are the adults? How fecund are the adults? How many eggs do they produce? And then last, we're looking at larval drift. So these are some of the things that we're looking at. And you can see that some of them are ongoing. These are some of the critters that we're working with. These are all polyvoltine mayflies. Some of you may recognize them, some of you may not. So let's go into the data. So first thing I want to talk about is metabolic acclimation. And we use Gilson respirometers to measure the oxygen uptake of individual larvae that are reared under these different temperature regimes. There's actually a larva in this reaction vessel right there. And with this instrument, you can measure microliters of oxygen uptake per hour. So these are what the data look like. Don't worry about these graphs. But basically, these are all data for one species. And each of the individual data points are an individual bug that was reared to that size. So on the x-axis is size of the bug. So it's getting, these are small and these are big bugs of the same species. So there's a big bug there, and there's a small bug there. And then this is respiration rate or metabolism in microliters of oxygen per milligram per hour on the y-axis. So this bug has a high respiration rate, much higher than this bug, okay? So you get a bunch of bugs that have been reared under this condition. This is the constant of 23.9 degrees centigrade. And you put them in the respirometer, and you measure the respiration rate, and you generate a regression that reflects respiration rate versus the size of the bug. And in all animals, these kind of graphs are negative sort of slopes. Small animals have a higher metabolic rate than large animals, whether you're an elephant, a mouse, or a mayfly. So all your graphs should have these kinds of negative slopes, and if they don't, then you've screwed up and something was wrong with that particular experiment. And there are a couple experiments that we screwed up. But basically, you see all the graphs are like this. And what you do is then you compare the regressions, the slopes and the intercepts of these regressions using analysis of covariance to determine whether or not you had a temperature effect on metabolic rate. So whether or not there is acclimation going on. And so I'm not going to show you 25 of these graphs, which we have, but just cut right to the chase. And these are the five species that we've done this for so far. And for three of them, we absolutely had no thermal effect at all. And for a fourth and a fifth one, yes, there was a statistically significant thermal effect, but no, there really isn't. It really isn't significant because we know why it was significant. That in one case, we had a in the 1.1 degree per hour graph treatment, we had a positive slope on our regression, so we had to get rid of those data. That was a bad set of experiments. Once we got rid of them, there was no difference between the other four. And then on the for this species, actually the graph for our control group, the ones that are kept at 23.9 degrees, had a positive slope. We had to get rid of those, and then we didn't have any difference among the rest. So basically, there was no evidence of thermal acclimation based on this approach with these five species. For our egg experiments, what we did was we artificially mated the mayflies in the laboratory. This is where Dave Funk gets his jollies. And then put the female in a jar of water, and the females nicely lay their eggs into a jar, and you can look at percent hatch and how long they take to hatch. Some of the species we work with were parthenogenic because we wanted species that we knew whether or not we were good at fertilizing the eggs wouldn't make a difference. And so for those, it was even easier to just take a female and stick her on water and she lays her eggs. You don't even have to, you don't have to breathe on her, she starts laying her eggs. Anyway, what we did was we would look in each jar at each clutch and pull out the larvae that would hatch each day and develop hatch frequencies for the each clutch and be able to determine what the hatch success rate was. And so here are some data, and the next bunch of graphs are going to be in the same format. On the y-axis is whatever we're measuring. In this case, it's what percentage of the eggs hatch in a given clutch. And on the x-axis, it's our temperature regime. So this is the control at a constant temperature. And this one is changing at a slow rate, a faster rate, a real fast rate, and then our 4.4 centigrade per hour rate. So wildly fluctuating diel regime at the very right. And if you have no effect, what you look for is sort of a flat graph. So basically, like this orange one, you go straight across, and you're getting the same percent hatch across all the temperatures. So there's no real effect of the fluctuating temperature regimes. So you can see that from these are three parthenogenic species, and here we don't worry about whether we did a good job of fertilizing the eggs. For two of the species, there's absolutely no difference in hatching rate across all the temperature regimes. And for one species, there was nothing going on for four, and then we have this little dip here for the fifth at our most wildly fluctuating one. But you have to take notice of the graph here, and this is still at 87% hatch frequency. So we went from 97 down to 87. That's statistically significant, but whether it's ecologically significant, you can decide. For our non-parthenogenic species, our bisexual species, we have more variability. And again, be careful here because the x-axis starts at 70%. So we were 70% successful at fertilizing the eggs in all cases. So we're doing pretty good. But you can see we have problems with some of our matings, and we think a lot of this variation is related to that. But there is some downward trend in the data. In other words, for this species, the hatch rate maybe dropped to 20% across our temperature regimes, and maybe for this one from 92 down to 80%. Again, whether that's ecologically significant, I don't know. In terms of how long it took the eggs to hatch, again, for our parthenogenic species, not much difference between our control and all the temperatures for this species. Again, we looked at the eggs once a day, and so here we have a difference of these are one-day increments, and so there's about a tenth of a day difference between the hatching rate of those. Here we have maybe a half a day difference between our most wildly fluctuating one and this one, and here, which is probably our best one, is maybe a one-day difference in hatching rate from our control to our most wildly fluctuating one. So we have some differences, but again, in the scheme of things, I'm not sure how relevant they are. For the bisexual, the same. We have more variability in the bisexual, but Again, this is 8 days to hatch here and about 8.5 days here with some variation in between. And again, it's maybe 7.2, 7.5. So in the scheme of things, given the differences in thermal regimes, we were pretty amazed at how tight the hatching was. And I should say that these are mean days to hatch. All these jars start hatching the same day, but some of the hatching were spread out more, so the means were increased going through. But it was pretty amazing to see all these jars hatching the same day across all the different temperature regimes. Now I take you to the larval growth and adult size data. And here we were growing things from first instar all the way to mature larvae and then to the adult. And the first graph is percent survivorship. How well did they survive? And this really varied significantly from species to species. So, you know, some of our species we only had between 25 and 40% survive, but we had more surviving in our wildly fluctuating regime than in our control. In others, we had better survivorship going up. But basically what we didn't see was a crash in survivorship across these temperature regimes for any species. We had differences among the species, probably related to how well they liked our rearing system, but we didn't see big crashes in mortality related to the temperature regimes. In terms of mean emergence and number of days it took to go from first instar to the adult stage, again, pretty flat. I mean, these are, again, in days. So there's 25 days here and maybe 24 and a half days at this most wildly fluctuating one. 22 point something here, 22 at the end. Really flat data. Males and females, we had the males emerging 1 day consistently before the females for our bisexual species, Cognatum, and in this one for Jolie. Basically not seeing much in terms of amount of time it takes to get to the adult stage, given these different temperature regimes that we were exposing them to. And then adult size, even flatter. For every species, for males, females, pretty much the same size adults coming out in all these different temperature regimes. Pretty remarkable. And then finally, for the drift experiments, in these experiments, instead of going out in the field and collecting larvae and trying to get 1,000 individual larvae of a given species of the same size and then running them in the laboratory, we tried that and we realized that you wind up with 1,000 individuals that are missing legs, missing gills, missing tails, limping around, and you know that you're just not going to get really good data. So what we did was we actually went out and collected larvae from the streams, reared them, mated them, and then produced mass quantities of same species larvae, same size, with all their legs, all their gills, and then put them in our rearing systems. And these are 3 meter long troughs lined with algal plates. We put them in there, they settle down, they start munching on the algae, and then we put them through the different temperature cycles. So we would sample those outflow nets. We would sample these outflow nets at different critical times throughout the diurnal cycle. So these experiments would go for 3 days. And during a diurnal cycle, we would sample them at all these different times where the arrows are. We would sample the nets to look for drifting larvae. And basically, here are the data. The top graph is the amount of larvae drifting out during the rising limb of a temperature. The middle graph is during at the end of a falling limb. And then the bottom is what drifts out when you turn the lights on in the morning. And you can see that for this species, nothing's happening on the rising limb in response to temperature. Nothing's happening on the falling limb. You turn the lights on in the morning and they go crazy. They start drifting all over the place. Two species behave like that. I only show data for this one. And then a whole bunch of species where we absolutely saw nothing. They didn't drift when the lights came on. They didn't drift in response to rising or falling temperatures all across the board. Nothing, nothing, nothing. So no response to drift in terms of the temperature fluctuations. So in summary, for the polyvoltine species we looked at so far, in terms of metabolism, no indication of acclimation. In terms of egg hatch, survivorship never fell below 70%, and eggs started hatching on or the same day across all treatments for every species, even though we got differences in the mean hatch rate. For larval survivorships, it varied from species to species, and this was really due to, I think, the rearing conditions. But within a species, the level changed across treatments was about 20 to 40%, but there was no consistent pattern in response to the temperature fluctuations. For larval development time, the total time varied by 1 day or less across all the treatments for most species. And adults started emerging across all the temperatures almost on the same day, repeatedly for species after species. It was amazing. Adult size, little or no variation across all the treatments for every species. And behavior, no indication of anything going on with behavior in terms of drifting. So tentative conclusion at this point, we're still working on this for another year or two, is that polyvoltine species do not seem to behaviorally or physiologically acclimate to or otherwise compensate for changes in temperature, especially on a 24-hour period. And every degree seems to count. Thank you.
This is the end of our discussion. There is time for questions for Dr. Sweeney, but also if anybody would like to ask Dr. Mary or Bill, my advisor. Any questions about their talks, please feel free.
John.
So Bert, you're anticipating some things you've got, say, in mid-Atlantic, like a shift performance
I think they will move, yeah. I think the subtropical ones will move north, and where temperatures, as Peter showed, low temperatures can really have a dramatic effect on polyvoltine species, and not surprising that there are temperatures in the mid-Atlantic states that are just not amenable to some of the polyvoltine southeastern, for example, mayflies, and that, yeah, they're going to move north, and I think they'll do really fine. Conditions that are less than optimal for some of these univoltine and other polyvoltine species will become optimal for our more southern species. We're going to see a big change, I think. I really do.
Sort of built into this is the basic assumption that temperature is the limiting factor for the distribution of these mayflies on your data.
Well, it's, that's another,
there
yeah.
There's
a lot of other things going on, absolutely, and this is just isolating one aspect of it. So based on temperature, yeah, this is what we would expect, but.
But do you feel like temperature would be a limiting?
Well, we know, you bring these bugs in the laboratory and you change food, you change this, you change that, temperature seems to be the one thing that they really, that you can generate orders of magnitude difference in things like adult size and fecundity and larval growth rate and things like that, whereas you can't generate that kind of variation using food and that sort of thing. So yeah, I think this is going to be a big factor. Is it the only factor? No. I mean, it's going to be a combination of things, yeah. Rich.
Why was your experimental design geared into such rapid changes in temperature versus long term? I mean, leaving it at maybe rearing one at 10 degrees higher for a continual to see if there were changes.
Well, we already know that. I mean, we know that at constant temperature, we already know that if you bring bugs in the laboratory and rear them at 5, 10, 15, 20 degrees, you can generate that, that's been done a million times, and you get a sigmoidal kind of relationship and so on. And what
was recirculating streams then, where all of a sudden you got a shot of 70 degrees versus you had it at 50? I mean, in other words, what I was trying to understand, are they being reared all of a sudden, you saw an upshoot in temperature, they're being exposed to a lot warmer water?
Yeah, I mean, the water, these are recycling systems with gradual new water being bled into them. But basically, yeah, they're sitting there seeing, they're at 20 degrees centigrade, and then all of a sudden they start gradually warming up, and they start, ramping up all the way to 28 degrees continuously till they get to 28, then they stay there for a while, and then they come back down. So yeah, it was trying to see whether their metabolism and they would follow those temperatures up and down on a diurnal basis, because that's what happens in small streams. And it's not surprising to me that this turned out this way, because I think in small streams like headwater streams, when you get these diurnal changes in temperature, that it behooves the individual to track them, and if they get up to 20 degrees for an hour or so, they should latch onto that and feed like hell and grow like hell, and because they're going to go back down at night. And I think unless they can do that, they can't make it through to their right emergence target at the right size. So this doesn't surprise me that this happened, but we needed to do it. And we were doing these experiments for a completely different reason.
Okay, my final question to tie into that is, did you look at accumulation degree days or to see if that changed to when they molted?
They all started emerging the same day. So we started them all the same day, and 25 days later, they all started emerging as adults. And we know that in those different temperature regimes, they were exposed to exactly the same number of degree days in every one of those treatments. So the degree days is constant. How they were seeing the degrees over a 24-hour period was really different between these regimes. And yet they came out, I mean, it was uncanny. Eggs hatch right on the same day, adults emerging the same day, the same size. I mean, basically they're counting degree days in this particular range of temperatures. Go a little bit warmer and you go into an asymptotic region of that temperature graph we just talked about, and maybe things will be different. But in the middle part of that kind of temperature rate curve, they're counting degree days, and basically it doesn't really matter how they're parceled out. Every degree is counting in their system.